The Daily Buzz on KCPW is sponsored in part by Sabra Hummus. Inspired by flavors from around the globe, Sabra's dips are handmade from fresh ingredients and spices. Sabra's mission is to bring healthy Middle Eastern cuisine to people's everyday diets. Online at sabra.com. The Daily Buzz from the 2014 Sundance Film Festival is sponsored in part by Soyombo Mongolian Vodka, crafted in small batches at the original distillery site of the last emperor's palace in Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia. Online at mongolianvodkas.com/soyombo.
It's the Daily Buzz at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Saturday, January 25th, it's our 10th day and our final day here on the Daily Buzz, coming to you from Park City, Utah, and the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. This is Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center here on KCPW, kcpw.org, filmlink.com, and on iTunes. Today's show, we're going to sort of present some of our highlights, some of our favorite moments and interviews from the past week over the course of this year's 2014 Film Festival. And at the end of the show, we'll do a little roundup, kind of looking back at the past week, highlights, lowlights, and all of our favorite moments of Sundance 2014. That's all coming up on the Daily Buzz here on KCPW, right after the news from the BBC. And we're back here on KCPW for the Daily Buzz from the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. This is Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center. It's been a great week here on the Daily Buzz, and for today's show, this final show from Sundance 2014, we're going to take a listen to some of our favorite programs, favorite interviews from this week's show. So stay tuned, and as we get to the end of the show, we'll also do a little final roundtable and look back at some of the moments that we remember and memories of this year's festival and talk about some of our favorite films and experiences at Sundance 2014. The film is called The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Schwartz, and back on the Daily Buzz, he was here a couple of years ago.
That's right.
Is the director of the film, Brian Knappenberger.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Congratulations, I should say.
Thank you.
Have your film at Sundance. I'm sure we take it all for granted when we talk about it on a show like this, but I can only imagine what the last few months, maybe year for you has been like. Tell us about it. Probably a mix of emotions.
Well, yeah, no, it's been a hectic year. I mean, we made this film just under a year, because it was exactly about a year ago, 1 week ago on January 11th, that Aaron took his own life. Mm-hmm. So I started making the film a couple of weeks after that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's been a pretty fast pace to try to understand, to tell a pretty complicated story about a 26-year-old that had an incredible number of accomplishments.
He's a fascinating guy.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to cut you off.
No,
he's a fascinating guy. And I think what I want to ask you to do as we start the conversation, for those who might be listening in and maybe the name Aaron Schwartz is familiar, maybe they've heard it, but maybe they don't realize what he's done or the complexity of his story. Just give us a quick thumbnail sketch of who this guy is and why he was so important. And we'll talk more about some of his impact in a minute.
Yeah, well, his story is really compelling for a lot of reasons.
His name is Aaron Schwartz.
Aaron Schwartz, yeah. He was really a software prodigy, young programmer that played a key role in some really early and critical kind of internet protocols like RSS. He also was the technical architect for Creative Commons. And he was a co-founder of the site Reddit, which is one of the biggest social news, the biggest social news website in the world. At age 19, he and his co-founder sold Reddit to Condé Nast. He became a millionaire. Yeah. And I think his story really starts getting interesting around that time. He turns his back on sort of traditional startup culture. You know, he thinks that the change the world slogan that people use often for that startup culture rang hollow to him, and he kind of dug in, dedicated in a really genuine way his skills to social justice, grassroots organizing, and political causes.
Important to note and to emphasize what you just said, because when folks think about sort of dot-com entrepreneurs, yeah. they think of a certain type of person. Aaron Schwartz was not that stereotypical type of dot-com entrepreneur. He was an activist.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, he played that game, right? That startup right. game, which yeah. is largely about build to flip, you know, create right. something, some website, some startup, and sell it to one of the big players and then yeah. kind of repeat this cycle yeah. of earning money. He found that hollow. He wanted to, I think, genuinely change the world. And he looked at it in a very kind of analytical way. What are my actions? What, you know, and what kind of effect are they really having yeah. in real life? And by doing this, he became this kind of brilliant and very kind of inspired political activist using new tools, using the internet, using this kind of massively networked world that we're in. He was very effective at that. But of course, his story is also becomes about this 2-year legal nightmare that he was involved with, which eventually led to his suicide.
We go into the film knowing that he's killed himself. We go into the yeah. film knowing effectively how it ends. We don't know how we're going to get there. What you're bringing to this film is an in-depth look at and hopefully creating an opportunity for us to have a greater understanding of what was going on in this guy's head.
Yeah.
What he was thinking. We hear in his own voice what he's thinking.
Yeah.
But let me flip to the end for those who are listening in mm-hmm. As sort of a teaser for the film. Why did he kill himself?
Well, I
Here's
think that
there's...
He
was a guy who was financially successful. He was making an impact as an activist. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's probably lots of answers to that question. Yeah. You know, whenever anybody takes their own life, there's not a simple answer. And I've kind of tried to resist the simple answer. There was a big, really international outcry after his death mm-hmm. That pointed a lot of fingers. And I think some of that is real. I mean, you know... I think that he had some, he was a very sensitive kind of guy. I think that the 2-year legal nightmare really took its toll on him. And you mentioned that he was financially successful. Well, the prosecution really drained him of all of his financial resources. The legal battle cost him millions of dollars. He didn't believe he was guilty. He didn't believe he was deserving of a felony. Mm-hmm. So he, for 2 years, decided to fight those charges. You know, in the film, we go through that kind of ramping up of that pressure that keeps increasing on him from the prosecutors. Mm-hmm. And I think that part of his story is particularly gut-wrenching. And it's also, you know, it's also lays bare the real problems with our justice system, mm-hmm. you know, handing over huge amounts of power to prosecutors, taking it out of the hands of judges, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. giving power of sentencing sometimes to prosecutors and not balancing that out. But I think it's also bigger. It's a story of what we lose when we kind of lose track of civil liberties and how it relates to our new technologies.
What do you feel is Aaron Schwartz's kind of lasting impact? And yeah. how is he influencing and affecting the discussion today? Certainly this film will be part of that, but what do you hope that impact will be, and what do you sort of see as his impact today?
I think he's one of those first people that was entering into that new world of that where realizing early on that there does need to be a blend between civil liberties and our technology. That our traditional values that have sort of served the Bill of Rights, the freedom of speech, search and seizure, these mm-hmm. kind of things. This is important to bring into this new networked world. I think he understood that really, really well. I think people are starting to understand that. I hope people take that away. But mm-hmm. on a personal level, you know, one of my favorite things he ever said in his blog was that he believed intelligence was not just, it was simply just curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I think that deep engagement with the political process is important. I think he showed us how to do that in new ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that just that kind of rigorous curiosity about these things is something that we need.
The film is The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Schwartz. And the filmmaker is Brian Knappenberger, who's been here with us today, and he's a return guest to The Daily Buzz.
Yep.
Brian, congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
On another terrific film, and welcome back to Sundance.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing the show.
Thank you very much.
And it's The Daily Buzz on KCPW, Sundance 2014. Across the table from a filmmaker who has a film called This May Be the Last Time. His name is Sterling Harjo. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Excellent.
So this is, we're going to dive right in. We have just under 8 minutes
okay.
To talk about your movie. And the film, which we'll talk about, and I want you to describe in a moment, is personal to you because it's about your own family.
Mm-hmm.
It's about your own grandfather. Tell us a little bit about the movie, but also I'd like to hear about any challenges you might have faced in deciding to explore such a personal story. What made you want to tell this story?
So it started out as not a personal story. It started out as a movie about just these songs that I wanted to tell a story about. And it's songs that I grew up hearing in my community.
Tell us about them.
They're actually Christian hymns that the Muscogee Creek and Seminole people sort of adapted and changed into their own thing. And they're influenced by Scottish missionary songs and also slave spirituals. And so they sort of have that kind of bluesy feel to it. They're all a cappella. They're just really unique songs. And I wanted to tell a story about these songs. And so in doing that, there was a story that I heard all the time growing up about my grandfather and the day he wrecked off of a bridge and they couldn't find his body. And so people searched for him. People camped out and searched for him for like a week.
This was in the early 60s.
Yeah, 1962. And they sang these songs while they were searching for him. So I wanted to put that in the film. But as I was making the film, all of these people that I was interviewing about the songs, it turned out that they were there. So it just became this bigger part of the story, story of my grandfather. So.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the filmmaking process. This documentary, as you mentioned, explores not only the people, but the music itself. Tell me about shooting it. Tell me about working within the community to make the movie. Tell me about the support you had to sort of enlist in order to tell this story as sort of in such an open way as you did.
You know, I scheduled the whole film myself, interviews and everything. Uh-huh. But instead of like, it was just, I knew that the approach to making this film was going to have to be different because, you know, I'm dealing with people from my community and you just do things differently. And so I moved back home and it was really just word of mouth. I was like, I'm making a film about these songs. So anyone that was really interested in talking, like I sort of found them or someone suggested them to me.
Word of mouth.
Yeah. It was sort of a word of mouth scheduling. And, you know, I really lucked out with some of the characters that I found and some of the amazing singers. It sort of felt like Alan Lomax going down to the, you know, Mississippi and capturing some of these singers for the first time, the last time even, or, you know, trying to preserve some of these songs. So,
well, it's in the title, This May Be the Last Time, because this music the people that are doing this and the music itself is kind of fading away, or maybe you're hoping that it won't.
Yeah, I mean that's the idea, and you know the title of the song means a lot. I think it there's the obvious thing of like this may be the last time these songs are sung, you know, and we need to save them. But also there's a song called This May Be the Last Time, and in our language it's espogades omis kithiskos, and it translates to This May Be the Last Time We Don't Know, which actually you can trace that song, and there's a slave spiritual song with the exact same lyrics. There's blues adaptations of it. The Staple Singers have a hit with the same song in 1960 something, and then in the 60s. And then the Rolling Stones have a song called The Last Time where they, and the lyrics are, this may be the last time we don't know, or whatever.
Yeah.
But the Muscogee Creek version is still the same. It's, you know, as it's always been, this may be the last time we don't know.
It just keeps getting reworked.
So really it's the title sort of means a lot. It sort of also is the title of a song that just shows the influence in history and music history that these songs have.
You talk about home being Oklahoma for you. You're a member of two tribes in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Tell me about family, and tell me about how your family felt about you exploring what ended up being a broader story, but you exploring your grandfather's story. It must be hard in some ways for especially older folks to sort of talk about this or still talk about it. It must be emotional.
It's weird because for me, like, it's a story that I loved growing up, but I think because I just heard it from my grandmother all the time,
right.
I never realized, you know, it never hit me that it was a real thing.
Right.
You know, it was just a story that I heard, but making the film made it very real to me.
Right.
And you realize that, oh, there's all these people that it affected, and there's these people that were there, and this guy's uncle, like, was the one who came up with the idea to dam the river that actually, you know, it's like all of these things kind of start coming together. And then you realize that it's a real event that happened, and someone really passed away, someone that I didn't know, but it affected my whole family forever, you know? Yeah. And my dad said something to me the other day that was really, you know, kind of really made me feel good about making the film, because he never knew him. He was five when this happened. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, because he was like, I'm really glad you made this film because it made me feel like I got to know my dad, you know, more. And wow. That's really something huge for someone to say, you know, because I know it affects him, you know, like I know that it affects him that he didn't know his father. But just to hear him say that was pretty amazing. And you know, like my grandma's in the film and she's really excited to see it, but she doesn't want to like watch it with the audience. And, you know, you just see that it's real. It's real. It's a real event that happened and it affected a lot of people. So,
well, you're certainly no stranger to Sundance. You've had a couple of films here in the past.
Yeah.
This festival can obviously cast a huge spotlight on a film. Mm-hmm. What do you hope the impact of this film will be? We have just under 2 minutes left. Yeah. What do you hope the impact of this film will be going forward?
You know, I just really think it's a film that I'm not worried about people liking it. Like, I know that they'll like it if they come see the film, you know?
The music is such a strong hook. That's what I took away from it.
Yeah, and it's people get emotional with it, and people really you know, it's like going to church. Even if you're not religious, you're still going to feel something in the room watching the film. So I'm just really excited to see as many people watch it as they can, you know, and I just would like to get it out there. Usually, you know, when I've been here with other films, maybe because I wrote and directed them and it was less of a documentary, but this is more personal, so I don't know. But this film, I'm less nervous about everything.
Really?
You know?
Yeah. You seem very calm about it.
For some reason, it's just like, well, if you don't like it, I don't know, like, you need to go to the mountain and pray or something. I don't know. Like, figure yourself out or something. But so it doesn't really stress me out too much.
The film is called This May Be the Last Time. The director is Sterling Harjo. 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
If people want to find out more about the movie, there's a website.
ThisMayBeTheLastTimeFilm.com.
ThisMayBeTheLastTimeFilm.com. Continuing on the Daily Buzz at the Sundance Film Festival from Main Street. And I've been really looking forward to this conversation. Talking about a film, a documentary playing here at Sundance called Cesar's Last Fast. Welcome, Richard Ray Perez.
Great, thanks. It's good to be here.
Your name tag says Rick, so can we call you Rick?
Yeah, my nickname's Rick. You can call me Rick.
All right, so very good. I would guess that, I would hope that most of the people listening in to the Daily Buzz today know who Cesar Chavez is. So we're going to assume that for a moment,
sure.
But as we kind of go through this conversation, we'll talk more about him and people will probably learn, just as with the film, things about him they might not have known. But maybe as a way of starting the conversation, the film is being introduced to the world here at Sundance. Give us a sense of why Cesar's story was interesting to you, why you wanted to tell this story, I guess.
Sure. I mean, I have a very close personal connection to Cesar's story. It's related to both my family history, my dad and his extended family were farm workers, and I grew up in a neighborhood that was very actively involved and immersed in that movement in the early 70s.
Where'd you grow up?
In the city of San Fernando, which is the northeast San Fernando Valley. So as a child, that era was very vibrant politically and very inspiring. Mm-hmm. And then years later, I developed a fascinating, I would describe it as almost a karmic relationship with the filmmaker named Lorena Parlee, who had started a film about Cesar. And ultimately, I inherited the project that she had started.
She passed away in 2006.
Correct.
Tell me about the relationship with her and the conversations that you had before she passed away. Sadly, she died. She had an extended battle with breast cancer. But tell the audience about some of those early conversations you had with her and then how you sort of carried out the project going forward.
Sure. Lorena heard that I was interested in doing a project, and she had already started a project.
Right.
She had amassed 85 hours of Chavez-related footage, and including about 20 hours that had never been seen by the public. She had been Cesar's press secretary during the late 80s. Mm-hmm. So she'd been working on a project. She heard I was working on a project. She gave me a call. And she said, hey, you know, I've been working on this project for 10 years. I knew Caesar. I have all this footage. I've been struggling to finish this film. I'm a team of one. Some people asked about, you know, coming onto the project, people I knew. And I told her that I didn't think they were right for the project. She really appreciated that. Then she went on and asked me if I would join her team of one, essentially, to come on board with the project. Mm-hmm. At the time, I just gotten my first director for hire job. I said, I can't do this. I'm tied up for the next 6 months. Mm-hmm. And she told me, well, I need somebody to help me now because I'm being treated for breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And I could only work on the film for 2 weeks out of the month. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of startled. And I said, well, you know, in 6 months, when I'm done with this job, if you haven't heard from somebody, call me and I'll join the team. Mm-hmm. And 6 months later, I didn't hear from her. I assume she found some collaborators. 9 months later, I get a phone call from a gentleman who says, hi, I'm Lorena Parley's stepfather. Lorena died last month of breast cancer. And she left her name in her notes for us to contact you immediately to see if you would finish her film.
Wow.
Do you want to finish her film? And so at that, what do you say? And at that point, it became sort of a mission and a cause.
And that was over 7 years ago.
Yes. So I got that phone call. It would have been the fall of 2007. Mm. Yes. They said, you know, her parents and I became friends. They said, all the footage is here in our garage. Come and take a look at it. Mm-hmm. And after we negotiated a sort of a legal agreement, I looked at all the footage. And I saw a film that was different than the film Lorena had started. Mm-hmm. I saw a film that was much more structured around his spiritual commitment, mm-hmm. Specifically around footage that Lorena had collected of a fast Caesar undertook in 88. And that eventually became the film Caesar's Last Fast.
Yep. So you talked a moment ago about the personal connection you feel with Cesar Chavez, with the issues he advocated for, and you talked about your growing up. Can you elaborate a bit on that and talk about some of the sort of maybe draw a stronger link to growing up in California and tell us maybe a little bit about sort of any thoughts, connections, sort of relationships you feel that sort of tie you back to that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Time.
You know, and when in 1969, I was 4 years old. I was in a preschool program, and there were these university students who'd come and volunteer. And one day, a university student came and volunteered. He sat down with my colleagues, my classmates, preschool classmates, and we were having lunch. And when it was time to eat our dessert that was part of this lunch, it was this horrible fruit cocktail and heavy syrup. Yeah. I noticed that he started plucking the grapes out of his fruit cocktail. And I was really curious, and I said, oh, how come you're plucking the grapes out of the fruit cocktail? And he said, well, because the people who own the grape fields, they treat the people who pick the grapes terribly. They pay them miserably. They humiliate them. They make them live in shacks. And if these people complain, they fire them. And I can't eat these grapes because of that. Mm-hmm. And I looked down at my grapes, and they become disgusting. And I couldn't eat them either. Mm-hmm. So I started plucking the grapes out of my fruit cocktail. And pretty soon, all the other preschool kids in the class at the desk started plucking their grapes out. And we couldn't eat those grapes for the rest of the year and for the rest of the time that we were in elementary school. It was a profound experience. And then I later learned that my dad, you know, before I was born, was picking grapes. And at that time, my aunts and uncles were still picking grapes.
Likewise.
And that there was a national boycott that was ended up being the most successful consumer boycott in the country. And it was led by a man named Cesar Chavez. So it was a very profound experience that happened to me when I was 4 years old, a very learning experience that I was later able to contextualize.
Powerful story. For those who are listening in and will hear about this film and hopefully have a chance to see it after Sundance somewhere, let's talk about Caesar's Last Fast.
Sure.
Tell us about his Last Fast and tell us about, for those who haven't seen the film yet, what you feel the impact of that Last Fast was.
Sure. So in 1988, Cesar Chavez was 61 years old at the time. In the late 80s, pesticides were loosely regulated in California and around the country. And what emerged was there were a few cancer clusters that emerged in farm worker communities in Central California. At that time, the United Farm Workers, the organization that Cesar Chavez has founded, had lost a lot of their power. And then farm worker children were being born with cancer. So as a both an act of penance and an act of protest, if you will, Caesar stopped eating. And nobody knew how long it will how long he would go before he'd eat again. And every day of that fast, which ultimately lasted 36 days, he was growing weaker and weaker, mm-hmm. and the family was becoming more and more concerned. The doctors were coming in to try to talk him into breaking the fast. The family would come in to try to talk him to break into breaking the fast. And Lorraine Parlee started shooting all this intimate behind-the-scene footage, just watching him grow weaker and weaker. Well, that film, that fast becomes the architecture around which we tell Caesar's entire story. The amazing things that he did, which is an overlooked story in our, you know, in our nation's narrative. So we
and it was a 36 day.
It was ultimately a 36
fast,
day
water
fast.
Only. He's only water drinking only. Water.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, when they when he broke the fast, he was so weak he had to be carried into a mass that 7,000 people attended. He was carried in by his sons, and at the right moment, a priest brings a piece of bread, gives it to Ethel Kennedy. He would come for that event. And she gives Caesar a piece of bread, and he has his first food in 36 days, and the crowd goes crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hugely powerful and emotional moment. I think that people, there are few times in American history do we get to witness that type of commitment. And so it's a amazing and profound way to tell Caesar's story.
It's a powerful story and a powerful film. In the 2 minutes we have left, tell us what you feel Cesar Chavez's sort of lasting impact is. What is the impact of his work on the same issues today? And the other side of that question is, what do you hope the impact of this film, that the impact of this film will be?
Sure. I mean, there was the immediate impact in terms that he really transformed how farm workers live and work, particularly in the Southwest. After his work, you know, now there are bathrooms in the fields, there are water, there are all these laws to protect them. I think on a larger level, he empowered a generation of Latinos to realize that they have the power to organize and that they have a place in this nation's history and that they can fight for social justice. He showed that successfully. I think what the film can tell us today is that there's a new generation of primarily Latino immigrants who don't know this history. And we want to introduce that model to empower them so that they can see that they can rally together, organize around issues like low income, around living wage, around raising the minimum wage, and around just social justice issues for all Americans. When we see the growing income disparity and the growing income gap in this country, I think this is a story that relates to today, what we can do to ensure that we're treated fairly economically. And I think it's vital for today, and I think it has a profound message for today.
Richard Ray Perez is the director of Caesar's Last Fast, debuting here at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Congratulations on the film.
Thanks, Eugene.
Best wishes with it as it heads out into the world.
Thanks.
And thank you for being on The Daily Buzz.
Thank you.
Continuing on The Daily Buzz, KCPW and kcpw.org. Streaming on the Film Society of Lincoln Center's filmlink.com and available via iTunes. Doing a remote segment here on The Daily Buzz, we've transported ourselves down Main Street to talk about a new movie directed by Stephanie Sotig. It's called Fed Up. And along with Stephanie here, we have two illustrious women seated on the sofa. Laurie David's here and Katie Couric, who's holding the mic. Thank you, Katie.
Anything I can do to help you, Gene.
Let's talk about Fed Up. It's a terrific new documentary. I was able to see it ahead of this interview, thankfully, so we could have a conversation about it. You're raising a lot of issues, and I'm going to start with Katie on this one. You're raising a lot of issues that are of such importance to, I guess, the way parents are raising kids. I guess if we start there, because there's a lot of information in this movie that I think will be eye-opening for some parents. And at the same time, some of the issues you're raising are challenging for parents because there's sort of infrastructures and structures that are built around the food that we and the food that kids eat today. Tell me why, Katie Couric, this film was important to you to be a part of.
Well, you know, as a television journalist for 35 years, I realized I had been covering this issue time and time again. A new study came out, a new statistic, you know, a new crisis in a different country. And I realized that I didn't think anyone had adequately taken a comprehensive look at the root of this problem, how childhood obesity had gotten worse and worse and worse, despite the fact we've been talking about it for decades. So that's when I approached Stephanie and said, you know, we really need to take a holistic look at this. And then Stephanie uncovered this systematic failure by our government officials, by the food industry, by marketers, that have resulted in a crisis that is leaving this generation of children down a path where they will live a shorter lifespan than their parents. And we thought, gosh, now is the time for a real wake-up call, because if we don't change the current trajectory, by 2050, 95% of Americans will be considered overweight or obese. And, of course, the ramifications of that in every aspect of our lives is huge, or are huge.
Let me ask a follow-up, and let me ask Stephanie to respond, because I think one of the most touching and actually heartbreaking moments in the film is a young girl who is dealing with some of these issues, and she can't even everything she eats and everything she tries to do, working out, exercising, it's not making a difference. There's a frustration, I think, maybe in the kinds of knowledge that's out there, or lack of knowledge that's out there, about what you need to do in order to tackle this problem. How did you find some of the people that you showcased in the movie?
So you're talking about Maggie, yeah. who when you see her doing the butterfly stroke, right? Like, who can do the butterfly stroke? And she swims for an hour 3 days a week, you know? And I think that was, for us, I think, incredibly powerful to see just how hard all these families were trying. They all were thinking that they were doing the right thing, and yet it just wasn't happening for them. And it was heartbreaking, and it gave us a real sense of obligation to help these families. And to your earlier question of how we found them, it was, you know, we just got incredibly lucky. It was, you know, we scoured the whole country trying to find children with different socioeconomic backgrounds and ethnicities in different parts of the country. And I really think that demonstrates just how far-reaching and how this problem affects everyone. You know, no one is immune from this.
Lori, you have a strong and illustrious track record in finding and raising these issues through documentary films. Tell us why this issue was so important to you.
Well, I came to this issue over my own personal experience as a mom, really, because I realized as my kids got older how important family dinner was. We had dinner 5 nights a week. We sat down, we ate real food that we cooked from scratch. And as my kids got older, I saw how, you know, they craved good food. My kids craved good food. They drink water with everything that they eat. And then I started to do research for a book on it and realized nobody was sitting down to dinner anymore. I mean, that basic thing that the basic tenet of family life is disappearing. And of course, as a result, it crosses with all these other issues. You know, it's one of the reasons why kids' palates are so bad, and everyone's eating half of what everyone's eating, they're eating outside of the house. It's being made outside of the house. And of course, if you don't cook it yourself, you don't know what's in it. But I can guarantee you it has more salt, more fat, and more sugar than you would ever put in as a mom making dinner at home. So when Katie emailed me, this happened over the internet. We'd only met once before. Of course, I've always admired her. And she asked me, would I be interested in joining her and Stephanie to work on this issue? It took me 3 seconds to respond yes.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about is the fact that the issue of childhood obesity has been raised at the highest levels of the country. The First Lady, Michelle Obama, has made it an issue and brought the issue to greater attention, raised and kind of shined a brighter spotlight. And yet, the movie raises some really tough questions for maybe the approaches that are being made. Certainly not that the intention is not there to address and tackle these issues, but that
it's a lot more, the situation is a lot more complex, and solving the problem is a lot more challenging than maybe anyone really realizes. To whoever wants to take this question, I mean, looking ahead, where do we go from here?
Well, those are sort of two questions. Yeah, I think, yeah. You know, the first one being how complicated it is. And I think, you know, a lot of us really admire Michelle Obama for tackling this issue, for taking it on. But unfortunately, I think she was guided by some of the same principles we prove are not necessarily true in terms of energy balance, exercise, let's move, calorie in, calorie out, that kind of thing. And then I think what Michael Pollan talked about so eloquently in the documentary is that often when backed into a corner, the food industry will try to deflect or switch the conversation or confuse the consumer, and suddenly they're talking about taking, what, 1.3 trillion, is that right?
Yes.
Calories out of store shelves. Well, what does that mean exactly? And how is that going to help us? And as we illustrated, you know, you may have an Oreo cookie that's, what, 5 fewer calories, but has the same amount of sugar in it. So, I mean, I think it's that we have to really examine, all of us and the food industry too, what kind of efforts are being undertaken and if they are in fact going to achieve the results that really need to be achieved.
To the parents that are listening, and people will have a chance to see this movie as it goes out into the world and they can follow up and find the film online and get more information about the movie when it screens. But to the parents who are listening, who might be alarmed by some of the statistics and information they're hearing, what are some very practical things that in your research and your investigation that you've done through this film, what are some very specific tips you could give to parents today?
I'll go first, here's a good tip, and it's a great math lesson for their kids. 4 grams equals 1 teaspoon. Sugar is listed as grams. I don't even know what a gram is. And I think that's intentional, right? So if we can start understanding 4 equals 1 teaspoon, people will be floored to see the amount of sugar in the products they're buying. And I think that they'll choose not to buy them.
I'm a new mom, and it's interesting. My son just started solids, and everyone kept telling me to start him on cereals, right? Give him Cheerios and rice cereals. And it was really interesting to me because after all we learned, I thought, why would I start him on something processed versus just whole foods, real food? That to me was a big takeaway, and something that I share with, you know, my fellow mom friends is feed your kids real food whenever you can.
And I think one of the interesting points, and I know that Lori has talked a lot about, and other experts I've interviewed on the topic, is that it takes a while to change a child's palate. You know, if they're used to eating junk, you know, you have to get your taste buds actually programmed to enjoy and appreciate new foods. So I think that, you know, that's a really important lesson, and that you have to introduce these new foods to kids, not one time, but we said it takes up to 10 bites to get a child to enjoy a certain kind of food. I would encourage parents to think about, especially moms, and I'm guilty of this too, when do we turn into short order cooks? You know, and I think the fact that we're saying our kids are picky eaters, well, I think we're actually enabling them to be picky eaters. And I guess this might be kind of controversial, but, you know, when I was growing up, my mom cooked one thing for dinner and we were expected to eat it. And by the way, in those days, you know, a platter wasn't considered a plate. You know, the portions were normal and reasonable. So I think that's just something to keep in mind, that, you know, it's really up to us to introduce our kids to a whole variety of healthy foods. And, you know, to really encourage them. And in some cases, you know, I couldn't leave the table until I ate my broccoli or my carrots or my peas. And I did try to hide them under my baked potato skins. But having said that, you know, like, let's give our kids a little tough love when it comes to their own health.
The film is called Fed Up. And I want to thank Lori, Stephanie, Katie for being here to talk about the film on The Daily Buzz. If people want to get more information, do you have a website or a social media place?
FedUpMovie.com, at FedUpMovie on Twitter, Facebook at FedUpMovie.
But we want to point out, Eugene, that this is not the end for us. This documentary, we're not on to the next thing. We really want to make this a mission. And there were a lot of things in the documentary we couldn't include. You know, there's so many issues attendant to childhood obesity. So we want to now use this as a platform and really a launching pad to help educate families even more, help them with healthier choices, help them be more discriminating and help them understand the food around them and the food environment and how they can fight it and protect their kids.
Katie Couric, Stephanie Sotig, and Lori David on The Daily Buzz. Thank you very much. As we wrap up this Saturday edition, this 10th edition of The Daily Buzz, I thought it'd be interesting to do and kind of fun to do a kind of roundup segment. We start each show with the hot topics with a roundtable of journalists and guests. Well, it makes sense to kind of end this 10th edition of The Daily Buzz here at Sundance with our own roundtable. So I'm at the table here with my colleague Brian Brooks from the Film Society of Lincoln Center.
Hello. Good night.
And our producer, Irene Cho.
Hi, Eugene.
Well, let's just look back. Let's talk about this year's festival. It's been, as always, a really exciting moment because this festival, as we've talked about every single day here at Sundance, this festival not only starts the calendar year, but it introduces new talent. It's a way for us, for journalists, for industry from around the world, for local audiences. Irene, you're based here locally.
Yes.
To meet the next generation of filmmakers.
It sets the tone. It sets the tone for the year.
You used to work for the Sundance Institute.
Yes, I did.
So you're very familiar as a
local.
That's
how we met.
That's how we
met. The press office.
Not only are you familiar as a local based here in Park City with the experience of Sundance, but you've had years to spend with this festival. How many years have you been attending?
Oh, gosh. I think this is my 10th year.
Wow.
10th year.
And yeah. Brian Brooks?
I'm a baby compared to you guys. Yeah.
Well, I figured out earlier in the week that it's my 16th, although I missed one was out of sequence. It was in the mid-90s I came kind of randomly, but otherwise it's been 15 in a row.
So and this is my 21st.
You celebrated your 20th last year.
Nearly 50 years of Sundance. 21 plus 16 plus 10, do the math. That's a lot of years of Sundance.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
It's been a fun year. I mean, it always is. If anything, surprising in that we didn't really have to dig out that that winter gear.
Yes.
Had a really,
beautiful
a
weather.
Really lovely. Weather. I want to thank everyone in Park City for providing such amazing weather when all of our friends back on the East Coast, for those of us who go back to the East Coast, are freezing and digging out of snowstorms. We've been just like so fortunate this week.
Oh, yeah. It's great.
And it was interesting earlier in the week, some people from New York actually got stranded here, so they got a little bit of extra Sundance.
A little bonus.
Yeah.
A little extra Sundance, a little extra sunshine before heading back to the snow. Let's just talk about some of our highlights. I think I'm going to throw out a couple of titles. For me, I really like the film, Justin Simien's film, Dear White People. Mm-hmm. He's a filmmaker that we had on earlier in the week, and he's a first-time director. He worked in the industry at Paramount and at Participant. He worked in PR. You can definitely see in the way that they've been announcing and unveiling the film, using some of the same strategies that he's employed for other films. But it's a really provocative and ultimately really funny take on what's a really serious subject. It's a film that I hope when the awards are announced later this evening and people get a chance to kind of take stock, it's a film that I hope people still remember, and I hope it's a film the audience remembers, but I also hope it's a film that the jury takes notice of, because he's a really talented filmmaker, and there's so many great filmmakers here at the festival, but on the narrative side, I think he's definitely a filmmaker to watch. His name is Justin Simien. Brian, you've seen some docs. What are some films that you liked?
Yeah, I mean, always at about this point in the festival, I kind of lament that I've wished I had time to see more. Of course, I mean,
there are
always such great
films.
I know, and you hear, you know, you go to parties and you see so many, you know, see so many people, and they talk about this great film and that great film, and you know, then I wish I would have gone to see that. But you know, it'll make it exciting as it continues to go on. But docs that I really loved this week were Overnighters. It was fantastic. I mean, it was such an interesting, intimate story, but it had such a broad, it had a very broad scope in how we are as a society. But told through the story of this one particular pastor. He's a Lutheran pastor in North Dakota, and he at his church, he is allowing migrant workers were actually migrant workers from other states for the most part, but other parts of the world as well. He allows them to sleep in his church. Mm-hmm. Because they're all going up there for this big, massive oil boom that's happening there. Mm-hmm. And it's in this small town that cannot accommodate this influx of workers, so mm-hmm. they have really nowhere to go. And he allows them to sleep in his church. And some of them have some problems, and some of them are just trying to improve their lives mm-hmm. and have a second chance. And the neighbors get a little skittish about it. And to be fair to them, I mean, mm-hmm. It's probably somewhat understandable, but mm-hmm. then there's also a bit of paranoia involved there, too. Mm-hmm. So it's told through this guy is just so compelling and very charismatic, and it's really interesting. And there's an interesting twist that happens that, of course, I won't give away. But that was a great film.
The director of that film, Overnighters, is Jesse Moss. He was on the show earlier in the week. Mm-hmm. Irene, you've obviously been very busy producing this program, but you've been able to see some movies.
Yeah.
Highlights?
I have to say, for me, the opening night film, Whiplash.
Right.
Miles Teller's performance was absolutely hypnotizing for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the energy around it, and we had Damien Chazelle on the show, and, you know, just his approach as a filmmaker, that really connected with me, as you know, I obviously don't have any musical talent, but it made me want to pick up an instrument mm-hmm. and learn how to play something. So I enjoyed that film.
A couple of films that I want to throw out that were really powerful and meaningful to me. On the first Saturday of the festival, our colleague Leslie Kleinberg mentioned this earlier in the week, two really powerful films that kind of interlocked. One's a documentary and one's narrative. The Case Against Eight, which looked at...
great film.
Yeah, marriage equality and the case against Proposition 8 mm-hmm. in California. Later that day, Ira Sachs's new film, Love is Strange, which looks at this aging relationship between these two men, played by John Lithgow and Alfred Molina. They actually get married at the start of the film, mm-hmm. and as the story unfolds, their marriage is challenged by the economic crisis. Mm-hmm. They're forced to move out of their apartment, and here they've spent decades together. They can finally get married, and the economy actually forces them to literally separate.
Right.
And it's a powerful story. It was an amazing Saturday, one of those really memorable kind of Sundance days and Sundance experiences. And it makes me want to sort of switch gears and talk about, you know, this is just one of those festivals where you know, I've been coming here now for over 20 years, and there's just certain moments at this festival. Irene, you worked for the festival. Brian, you've mm-hmm. been coming here for a long time, 15, 16 years, many of those years as a journalist. I don't know. There's certain moments that you always treasure as being Sundance moments.
For me, I would say Hustle and Flow. That film,
that was good.
For me, represents how things can organically start at Sundance. And I loved being at Eccles and mm-hmm. watching that film and being with the audience and just getting involved in just the energy and, you know, the excitement. And that really stood out for me as one of the things I will always remember.
Well, one that actually that stood out for me, and Eugene, you mentioned earlier in the week as a stand-up for you from a while back, was Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And I think I was sitting next to you at that screening, and it was just magical in there. It's just Sundance particularly, I mean, other festivals do this well too, but Sundance particularly just has these magical moments. And I don't know if it's the energy from, well, obviously it's the film first and foremost, but just the characters that come that you know, are up on the stage and the mm-hmm. audience. And that was a particularly amazing Hedwig and the Angry Inch from... Gosh, I'm afraid to even think. Oh, no.
I think it was around 2000.
I think it was around 2000.
2001.
Yeah.
I don't know. Somewhere in that range, certainly.
But I have to share. I have a funny story. Because when you work for the festival, the irony is you're so busy, you never get to watch films. So I will confess that a lot of times I use that time mm-hmm. to take little naps. And I remember that I went to go see the Beastie Boys documentary at the library, and I was so excited to see it because it was the first film. Uh-huh. As soon as I sat in my chair in the library theater, I fell asleep. That film was like all music mm-hmm. and it was like 2 hours of just straight like music and, you know, excitement and audience, and, you know, it was a great piece, but I fell asleep the entire time and I'm so embarrassed. But I will always remember that as being one of my favorite films.
A great moment. You know, we've talked about him a few times on this show, and there was a man who was part of this year's festival who's had a long history with this festival, Roger Ebert, mm-hmm. Subject of Steve James' new film, Life Itself. Same title as Roger's autobiography, and he passed away this past year. But he's another one of those sort of figures that you just so associate with this festival. You know, there are certain people that you just associate, the moments you remember.
I remember I was in the audience at the library when Better Luck Tomorrow premiered.
Yes.
And they had that banter with the audience, and it was so...
Roger stood up to defend the film, exactly. And people in the audience were criticizing it.
It was it was very momentous for the filmmaker and also, I think, the sales agent, Jeff Dowd.
Yeah.
And it was you know, that's the kind of stuff that you read about and then you don't even actually think that you could experience.
But well, as Brian said a minute ago, you know, it's just one of those kind of things, that kind of the perfect storm that happens at a festival like this, where the film, the audience, the industry sort of come together and create these very memorable moments. It's been really fun this year to once again kind of document them in our kind of real-time way on the Daily Buzz with these daily interviews, bringing so many great filmmakers through. I mean, it's always amazing to just kind of sit down and just hear their stories.
You know, it's our fourth year, Eugene.
It's our fourth year doing this. Isn't I can't
crazy?
Believe that we've, you know, we've gone from, we were over on
Sweet Alley.
Now we're here on Main Street.
No,
I want to make sure we thank, we have a lot of people to thank as we wrap up this final edition, but I want to make sure we thank the venues, the Microsoft Million Square Foot Lounge. They've been really great, as well as everybody at the Chase Sapphire Lounge. Both on Main Street. And it's been really fun to have the show on Main Street, really at the heart of the festival, where all the energy is.
It is the pipeline.
It is really the center of it all. We have a number of people that we want to make sure that we thank and acknowledge. First and foremost, let me thank our sponsors. Soyombo has been so great and supportive, and we want to thank them especially, as well as Sabra and Skullcandy. Skullcandy is a local Park City organization. Their product, their headphones are all around the world, but they come from here in Park City. So thank you to them, as well as Sabra. They've been supportive for multiple years on this festival.
Great hummus.
We have in-kind supporters. You want to thank our in-kind supporters?
Sure. We have some support from the Park City local community with super good bars, all good provisions, and people water.
Let me thank the city of Park City, of course, always warm and embracing, as are the Sundance Institute, producers of the Sundance Film Festival. Let me single out the individuals who make this show possible. The staff include Lancia Wan, who's been here for a number of years. She's back again. Thank you, Lancia. Ross Chambliss, Lauren Handley, Elisa Gustafson and Sarah Wagner, Kevin Artifer, Melissa Mobley, Claire Chen Carter, Sandy Miller, as well as everyone at KCPW, Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis in particular, from the Institute. I want to make sure we thank Sarah Eaton, Casey De La Rosa, Lizzie Lattenser, Emil Scheik, as well as Anna Hansen. Heather Webster from Mother New York.
Oh, they were amazing.
Emily Coy from Ketchum PR.
Thank you, Chase.
Henry Eshelman. A number of folks from the Film Society.
Leslie Kleinberg, Courtney Ott, David Nin, John Wildman, Nicholas Kemp. Obviously, Brian Brooks, our co-host, and Linda Yang.
And everyone at the Film Society. Look forward to seeing you back in our office very soon. I want to thank our producer, Irene Cho.
Oh, thank you, Eugene, and our host, Eugene Hernandez.
It's been a really fun year here on The Daily Buzz. The Daily Buzz at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival on KCPW and kcpw.org. You can catch back episodes of the show on filmlink.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Signing off from Sundance 2014 with Irene Cho and Brian Brooks. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a really great time.
This is Eugene Hernandez on KCPW.